We're going to unofficially call the meeting to order. We're still lacking a quorum. We'll officially open the meeting when we have the quorum. But we've got a long agenda, and we want to get start getting through this. The first item on the agenda is to get an update from the Department of Revenue with regard to tax analytics and reciprocal agreement status, following up on legislation from last session. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Mossman.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Matt Mossman with the Department of Revenue, and with me is Greg Cheetah, our Chief Information Officer. As well, I appreciate the committee's time this morning. We're just going to give you a brief update and happy to answer any questions, obviously, that you have on where we're at with tax compliance and data analytics efforts. You should have a handout that we passed around, is included with your packets or at your chair. Just to kind of a little bit of background context, the current tax compliance initiative that was passed in the 2011 legislation appropriated the department $13.7 million for the fiscal 12-13 biennium for tax compliance activities with the as well as tax analytics and business intelligence tools, with the expectation that the department would generate gross additional revenues of $82.3 million from those efforts. Last year, the Department of Revenue collected $15 billion in revenues, of which $617 million, or about 4%, was direct compliance enforcement. So in context, from the accumulated efforts of tax compliance activities prior to last year's legislation, we collect about $617 million a biennium, and then that $82.3 million will be on top of that. Going to the next slide, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Mossman, we do now officially have a quorum, and so we will call the meeting to order. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Increased tax compliance efforts show good results. In December, you'll recall that we reported having collected $6.1 million of the $82.3 million revenue target for the fiscal 12-13 biennium. As of the end of February, we have collected about $15.5 million of the $82.3 million. So we've collected about 19% of the biennial revenue target at this point. That is, the pace is picking up, which is kind of typical in these tax compliance initiatives, that it takes a little while to get an initiative up and running when it starts. So we're progressing, I think, comfortably, and most of the revenues, just for background, at this point are the result of increased efforts in the collection of delinquent debts. The next slide, Mr. Chairman and members, just gives you some history in context of how our compliance revenues that are collected through tax compliance have grown over time as a percentage of the total revenues that the department collects on behalf of the state of Minnesota. The department collects about $18 billion a year in various taxes on behalf of the state of Minnesota, of which direct compliance efforts now amount to about 4.1% of those revenue collections. The one thing that I would point out on this slide, of course, Mr. Chairman and members, is that it is also an indicator that, you know, voluntary compliance is something that we definitely want to take a look at emphasizing and getting back to. I think in some metrics you might have almost want to see this slide, this bar chart, going down rather than up in terms of what you want to have is taxpayers voluntarily complying with the tax code if possible. Tax analytics update. Just a little bit of background again to set the context. Contracts were signed and the Department of Revenue engaged with approved vendors starting in December of last year. Tax analytics, there were 22 data analytics vendors that were certified by the Department of Administration as part of the master contract that was completed, and 10 of those vendors were certified to provide analytics in the area of taxes. Prior to that certification and those contracts, the department had already taken steps to initiate a team of agency leaders to prepare for and start shaping agency strategies around tax analytics. So the conversation at the department started obviously immediately following the legislation that was passed by the legislature last year with the expectation around tax analytics increased activity. We have met at this point with 9 of the 10 vendors. The 10th vendor chose not to pursue tax analytics at this time. They're pursuing analytics with other agencies. We met with those vendors to better understand the tools and techniques that the vendors are offering. We have since then proceeded to have additional meetings with most of those vendors as well. The certified vendors offer a range of tools, including enhanced fraud detection, transfer pricing support, improved audit selection, and assistance in the area of collection case prioritization. We're in the process, Mr. Chairman and members, of reviewing and considering all of those options. And like I said, we've received demos from many of those potential providers and are engaged in proof of concept work with several of them as well.
Again, I'm Greg Cheetah. I'm the Chief Information Officer for the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I want to talk a little bit about the proof of concepts, or pilots as they're called. Proof of concepts are actually very key to help us determine where we can apply analytics. I mean, there's lots of offerings, but the Department of Revenue actually is doing quite a bit already. And so what we are trying to do is ascertain which ones are the best fit for the Department of Revenue, where they can bring and add additional value to what we are doing rather than just give us a different way of doing essentially what we're doing right now. We have a number of things underway. We have things in fraud prevention, and there we're really trying to have a goal of preventing refunds from going out, particularly those, you know, those non-refundable credits and the rest, because once they're out the door, they're much more difficult to get back. We've also got enhanced audit selection, and there we've really got a goal of minimizing those marginally good audits where we go out and find out that people are doing everything substantially right, and really focusing on those who are more non-compliant and further from compliance. And then also selecting, we're also looking at collections in a number of other areas. We've actually got a few of the pilots underway. We've got the results back from one. We just got them back, but we've got some initial things that I can talk about in a little bit. We are also still reviewing some early audit during the processing stream so that we can capture things and flag them right at the beginning. As Matt said, we're taking a look at some transfer pricing support, some flow-through entity relationships. This is where we can take a look at the parent-subsidiary relationships and actually track if somebody's doing something wrong someplace. Other options for us to take a look at where some of their subsidiaries might be doing the same type of behavior. And then we're well into the evaluation of a number of statistical software packages that help support the analytics. talk a little bit about our first proof of concept. In our first proof of concepts, we're working with a vendor that specializes in fraud prevention and identity theft. And the way this proof of concept worked, we grabbed the complete file from a tax year, cleaned it up a little bit, presented it to the vendor, and they matched it with a lot of information that they have that they're very proud of, and also some of their analysis. And they came back and said, based on our analysis, here's areas where we think that you should have stopped people and take a look at it. And by using the prior tax year, we can actually compare it to what we actually did, because we didn't give them the final result. We gave them the same information that we had that basically came out and whether or not we gave them a refund. The early results are that in reviewing their initial presentation to us, we have determined that the Department of Revenue's existing processes caught all 9 of the scenarios that they had presented, which we're a little proud of. We take our business very seriously, and this was a very good validation of what we are doing. That doesn't mean that we are not getting value out of the process. It just means that it's a validation that we are looking at the same things and that we had the same type of results. And even though this, you know, their scenarios appeared suspicious from a data analytics standpoint, you know, these refunds were caught, and many of them were corrected by the Department of Revenue. And many times, though suspicious, they actually were, the taxpayers were due a refund because of the situation. What are our next steps? We've got a number of proof of concept studies, as I said, that are underway, and some that we are still considering. At this point, the Department of Revenue has not thrown any idea out. We are still, you know, open to new ideas even. We continually explore new opportunities to apply analytics, something that we're very excited in the department, and we're really striving to find those things that can really help us and get us better than what we are doing right now. Then we will enter into contracts with the vendors for services and tools where the added value can be demonstrated. And then we're going to incorporate the chosen vendor solutions into our ongoing operations. We really want to operationalize the ultimate goals and have it just become part of our way of doing business.
Mr. Chairman and members, that's where we're at on tax analytics. And I have a couple slides here. I know that there was... you wanted an update on where we're at with the Federal Reciprocal Program also. I can walk through that and then take questions at the end if that's your preference. To refresh, legislation that was passed last July allowed the Department of Revenue to implement a federal-state reciprocal program with the U.S. Department of Treasury. You may recall from those discussions that under current practices, the Department of Revenue was already in a relationship with the Department of Revenue whereby we were offsetting income tax debts for each other and collecting revenues on unpaid state and federal income tax debts in that fashion. This new arrangement will allow the Department to offset federal vendor payments for Minnesota state debts to include tax and other state agency debts. And so that's the new activity that we're pursuing now. It allows for the offset of Minnesota payments as well to collect federal non-tax debts. So we would collect federal non-tax debts on behalf of the federal government. The expected revenue from the reciprocal agreement is $4.3 million from the biennium, $500,000 this fiscal year, and $3.8 million next fiscal year. We have at this point, Mr. Chairman and members, completed the steps that would are needed to fully develop the reciprocal agreement, as you may recall. Also during the session conversation, having SWIFT fully implemented and having the rollouts of our integrated tax system for non-tax debts and for special taxes completed were key steps in making creating the platform for us to be able to do this. And so we completed in December 2011 the rollout for our non-tax debts into the integrated tax system, and we completed the integrated tax system final rollout, phase four of that implementation, in February 2012. In progress right now, we are in the process of creating and testing, or have created and are testing, file formats with SWIFT, DHS, and the Federal Treasury. So all of those tests are right now hopefully in their final phases. We have implemented a faster automated process to communicate and transfer files with the Federal Treasury so that we're able to do this more efficiently going forward. And so we have that new system in place. And so we at this point, Mr. Chairman and Committee, are on schedule to have this additional federal offset program up and running in April, which was the conversation during session last year. With that, Mr. Chairman and members, we obviously are marketing what we are hoping to be a very successful rollout of the department's new website on the last slide, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Mr. Mossman, you mentioned having the offset thing resolved by soon. What about the full implementation here of this initiative? Can you give us some kind of sense as to how much time going forward is going to be needed to fully implement?
Mr. Chair and members, If I understand the question correctly, there are a number, you may be referring to, there's a number of phases, additional things and timelines that the federal government that are required. There is a 60-day requirement that we need to, before we can actually start collecting revenues through the system, we have to give vendors a 60-day notice that we may be, that there will be subject to recapture, and we expect to begin notifying those vendors next week. So that process is also up and ready, which also is consistent with the timeline that we anticipated last session. So, you know, it'll be 60 days before we're able to start collecting, and then at that point, Mr. Chairman, we would consider the system to really be fully functioning at that point, and so we would be collecting on a routine basis as those, as the systems, if you will, match up the tax ID numbers of the vendors relative to the debts that are owed either the state or the federal government.
Okay. Mr. Shida, recently in the news there has been reports about fraud involving collecting someone else's refund that's due. The vendor that you've got working on that, you feel that that vendor is going to be able to help us prevent that kind of fraud going forward?
Chairman Lanning, members of the committee, we're actually working with, I believe, three vendors right now in the area of fraud detection and identity theft, and taking a look at a number of different options and things like that, trying to find out which will work best for the state of Minnesota. It is a huge issue out there. We have a number of things in place. We have been working on this, and actually, I believe the Minnesota Department of Revenue has been a leader in some of the work on this, but we're always looking for something better, and so it isn't just one vendor that we're working on with that. It's a number of them right now, and we do have, I believe, one more pilot already that we're trying to work on, proof of concept, and we received just, I believe, on Monday, another proposal from a vendor that we're looking at very seriously.
Well, if I could add, Mr. Chairman, that's just to underscore the importance of these proof of concepts. What we're really wanting to try to make sure that we do is that we don't just immediately start purchasing and spending state resources to purchase products without knowing how they're going to compare to our existing activities and where either efficiency gains or enhancements of compliance efforts, so that we're able to target the best tools to what the needs are and how we can supplement the compliance efforts. So.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mossman or Ms. Cheetah. Mr. Cheetah, you talked about the collection of delinquent debts, and you said you've collected 19% of that. Is that mainly businesses here in the state of Minnesota, or is it individuals, and is it these debts, are they also outside of the state of Minnesota that we're looking at? What percentage of that, and what do you look forward to as collecting more of that?
Mr. Chairman and
Mr. Rosman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, I'm happy to take a stab at that, and then if Mr. Cheetah may want to supplement. What these are, these would be debts that would be in collection status, and I believe they could probably be either businesses or individuals. They would be debts that would be in collection status, and so what that means is they've already gone through the process of, if there's been an assessment and an appeal, or if they've filed their tax return but they've been unable to pay, so the determination of what is owed has been made, and that simply the payment hasn't been made, and so we're in the process of collecting the payments.
Additionally, they could also be non-tax debts that we could collect as well.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are these basically Minnesota companies or entities, or are they outside of the state?
Mr. Chairman and members, I think they could be either, of course. They're taxpayers that owe the state of Minnesota. Most payers to the state of Minnesota are either Minnesota residents or Minnesota companies. That's where I mean, most of our tax base is, but it could be either.
Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question has to do with the reciprocity between Wisconsin and Minnesota. We had a meeting recently with legislators from Wisconsin and Minnesota, and I'm just wondering if you can give me an update kind of where we're at with that question.
Mr. Mossman.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the question. You know, the commissioner obviously has been engaged in those conversations with the governor's office and the state, and so I'm a little bit less familiar with those conversations, but they the conversations with Wisconsin have been ongoing. I know we've been communicating that the first and foremost, the study is well underway. Both states, as you may recall, were required to do a study in order to establish what the net revenue loss would be so that any sort of compensation from one state to the other could be determined, and that is underway with the research departments in both states respectively. And at that point, then now the conversations are definitely ongoing in terms of what the specificities of the agreement would look like.
Representative Murray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and this could be for either Mr. Mossman or Mr. Cheetah. What are the major reasons for non-compliance? Are we finding that we need more education out here, or do we have people that are just avoiding taxes? Just would like to know a little bit about that, first of all.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, you know, there can be a variety of reasons for non-compliance. Generally speaking, you know, most taxpayers voluntarily comply. I believe in the neighborhood of 96% of our revenues come through voluntary compliance. So, and that is, you know, it's an important question in that we're very cognizant and wanting to make sure we have adequate emphasis on voluntary compliance at the Department of Revenue in terms of strengthening our relationship and maintaining a strong relationship with taxpayers, making sure there's adequate education and outreach out there, and those are things we definitely want to focus on and maybe focus on more because that is the lowest cost and most efficient way for us to collect taxes, both from our standpoint and from the standpoint of taxpayers. So in having emphasis there is important. In terms of non-compliance, there can be a range. I think obviously there's taxpayers who do intentionally try and avoid the tax code in various tax types. And there's also, I think, challenges. Sometimes it's the timing of when taxpayers are willing to pay. And then there's obviously disputes over interpretations on occasion of the tax code. So I think there can be, I would say, and generally, they probably fall into those categories.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, members, we've got a full agenda here today, be brief. Yeah.
Just acknowledgement that, I mean, many times we sit around this table and we're looking at people coming to testify in front of us and we're trying to find things that are wrong, and I would just like to acknowledge the good work that you've done, and it was good to hear that you your compliance caught many of the things that happened here. So it's good to see that happen too, so thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Simon and then Stensrud, and then we need to move on. Simon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Kahn, who previously chaired this committee, are always interested when it comes to the budget year of a reasonable ratio that we can expect when it comes to compliance. And this is a rare opportunity we have in advance of next year when we're not in the swirl of budget politics to get your view, if you have a view at this point, about what going forward, let's not talk about looking back, just going forward, do you have a sense of what a reasonable ratio would be so we can start thinking about 2013 if we need it? Maybe we won't need it when the forecast comes out in December, but if we need it, what is, or if you could even give us a range of a reasonable ratio between dollars put in and what we can expect out of compliance, as Representative Kahn and I know Chair Lanning have shown us in the past, that ratio tends to fluctuate and over time maybe generally goes down as we sort of pick the low-hanging fruit first. Can you give us a little sense of the ratio going forward for 2013?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Representative Simon, thank you for the question. That is that is maybe the, I'm not sure if it's the $82 million question right now, but it, you know, I think it, we have a new initiative underway, and generally speaking, once we get into it, and I know you're looking for kind of a heads up now, but it really is something that kind of plays out as we progress through the initiative and see where we're at. We did feel from the conversations last session that we were kind of pushing a little bit to remain at the 6-to-1 ratio that we're at with this initiative. I think an important part of the conversation as well is, you know, we do hear a number of concerns as well from both the public, from taxpayers, and sometimes from yourselves, in terms of we have a lot of touch points because we've had a number of tax compliance initiatives that have accumulated over the years. So with each new initiative, we continue the old initiatives and fold a new one on top of it. And so as a result, we're interacting with more and more taxpayers over time, and obviously sometimes there's a bigger return on investment within each individual case, and sometimes they're fairly small. And so we're trying to find a good balance between shifting focus maybe back to just voluntary compliance efforts rather than additional compliance efforts. But I think at this point, we're at the 6-to-1 ratio for this compliance initiative. That's what we're expecting to achieve, and whether or not we're able to achieve that, I think, or whether or not we have to, maybe part of that will be, we're obviously hoping that a significant part of that will be tax analytics improvements as well. And so, over time, I think we'll have a better sense of whether or not that could be maintained if there were additional initiatives.
Representative Stensrud, and then we need to move on. Pass, okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman,
gentlemen, for being with us today. Appreciate it. Next on the agenda is House File 2909. Let's, while waiting for Representative McElpatrick to assume the table, would someone move the minutes from yesterday?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lohmer moves the minutes of March 21st. Any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor of those minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Representative McElpatrick, your bill. You want to move your bill?
Yes, I would like to move House File 2909, and it would go to Ways and Means, I believe.
That's correct. So the motion is to recommend it pass and be sent to Ways and Means. You may proceed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am happy to bring this bill here to the committee this morning. Continuing our look at taking care of our veterans. We have, as you know, a fairly high number of veterans in Minnesota related to other states. These men and women have given up from their own pursuits and interrupted their lives in order to serve in our military and make sure that we all can live at home in peace. Many of our people have served multiple deployments, and these become an enormous interruption in their work histories. And finding jobs when they come back home can be challenging. With the drawdown, there will be even more men and women returning, and it's important that we plan in advance as much as possible to provide for reentry into civilian life and quality jobs. This bill would provide for the establishment of a program to assist our veterans with either an apprenticeship or an on-the-job training program. The programs would need to be run by employers that qualify under criteria that is approved by the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs, and they would need to be at least 6 months in duration. The Commissioners of Deed and Labor and Industry would be involved in determining which programs would qualify. Apprenticeships and on-the-job training usually have modest associated costs, and this is reflected in the amount of the subsidy. Either of the programs, on-the-job or apprenticeship, would qualify for a maximum stipend to the student of $2,000 for a year. Following completion of the training program, an employer that hires that person would qualify for a $1,000 hiring credit, and at the close of 12 consecutive months of employment following training, there would be a second $1,000 credit incentive. The total amount that could be paid for this entire package would be an amount not to exceed $3,000 per calendar year. Funds for the program would be drawn from the Minnesota GI Bill, and I would like to introduce Matthew Meyer, who is here this morning. He is an attorney, he is an advocate for veterans, and he specializes in employment issues.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Matthew Meyer. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It is an honor to be asked to testify before the committee to discuss these issues critical to many Minnesota veterans. I am Matthew Meyer, a Marine veteran and attorney with the Minneapolis law firm of Moss & Barnett. I'm also a volunteer ombudsman with the Department of Defense Employer Support of the Guard and Reserve Program, ESGR. However, I've not been authorized to speak on behalf of the Department of Defense, and the testimony I'll provide today should not be construed as official DOD policy. ESGR's principal mission has traditionally been centered on the Uniformed Services Employment Reemployment Rights Act, a federal law that requires civilian employers to reemploy service members that they are called after they are called to uniform service. One of the principal missions that have evolved, especially since late 2010, when the Secretary of Defense became aware of significant unemployment among the veterans, especially the post 9/11 veterans, was to address the veterans unemployment issues through the ESGR program. The post 9/11 veterans face substantially high unemployment rates compared to their civilian counterparts, approximately 22% to 30%, depending on the age group actually considered. The Secretary of Defense assigned the ESGR with the expanded mission of the Employment Initiative Program. This is a vigorous effort to provide job search assistance to veterans through the national database located at h2h.jobs. It is referencing Heroes to Hired, and that provides various job search assistance, job search services such as resume assistance, certification programs, etc. The ESGR also allows their individual committees to provide substantial assistance or collaboration as they see fit. Here in Minnesota, we have launched a collaborative program with the state and local employees that deal with these veterans' issues. For instance, we collaborate with the veterans' employment representatives in the individual counties and throughout the state. And in doing so, we have connected up needy veterans who are facing employment, underemployment, or unemployment issues with employers who have shown a willingness and a desire to tap into the substantial skills and experiences that these veterans have and offer to their employers. Unfortunately, the issue that we often come across is the lack of education or relevant experience relative to the job that is being sought. And one thing that we do see rather regularly is the comparative disadvantage that these veterans have vis-a-vis their civilian counterparts, especially when dealing with post 9/11 veterans. In the age group of 18 to 24. These veterans face substantial challenges when it comes to competing with their civilian counterparts because of various reasons. Perhaps the lack of an adequate network to locate jobs or to have references. But oftentimes it's just not having the kind of relevant work experience that can translate to the civilian job itself. And that's where this bill comes into play. We believe that it is a substantial step forward in assisting these veterans, these unemployed and underemployed veterans, in having something to show on their resume relevant to the job that is being sought so that they are given a fair advantage in the workplace. As the representative mentioned, there's going to be a substantial issue going forward. Even though right now Minnesota has the third largest disparity between the unemployment rates for veterans compared to their civilian counterparts, the situation is probably going to get worse before it gets any better. As everybody knows, the Department of Defense has announced substantial drawdowns and reductions of forces in all of the services. As a Marine, of course, I'm particularly concerned with the 20,000 Marines who are going to be discharged over the next few years and the 80,000 soldiers who are going to be discharged. But, you know, keep in mind that these are the groups of veterans that can be most benefited by this type of a program and are most disadvantaged when it comes to reentering the civilian workforce. These are Marines and soldiers who may not have skills and experiences easily translatable into the civilian workforce. Hopefully there are many employers out there who can recognize the traits and principles and characteristics of these veterans and benefit them, but unfortunately there are many civilian employers out there who can't understand how those experiences can translate into the job that they're offering. So it is critically important that we provide education, but also these apprenticeships and on-the-job training programs so that we can help these veterans with their resumes to make them more marketable to their civilian employers. But as I was mentioning, there's going to be an influx of a large percentage of young veterans, 18 to 24, and keep in mind that currently the unemployment rate is almost 30% in that group. I don't know what it will be once there are 100,000 new veterans hitting the job market. It depends on the economy and many other factors. But it is important to keep in mind that these veterans have sworn the oath to their country to serve and to protect the country. And it is important that we provide for them the tools necessary to make the transition easier from the military that they served and the country that they protected to a profitable and successful career, you know, rather than facing disadvantages as soon as they take off the uniform and walk into the employer's office seeking a job.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Questions from the committee? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer, you mentioned 22 to 30% unemployment rate. How many of these veterans do you project, or have you had surveys or information about, that would take advantage of going into this program? Or I know that some people come out of the military and they go, well, I've got enough, I don't need any more. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on how many you have any background information about that.
Mr. Meyer?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson. There is some statistics from the Bureau of Labor Statistics dealing with where these veterans are going into, and without citing numbers, my sense is that especially with the younger veterans, the 18 to 24 range, which, you know, is a principal concern in my mind anyway, because these are young veterans who likely do not have an education. They came out or they went into the service enlisted, and if they're a grunt like I was in the Marine Corps, if they're infantry, that's a skill that is not easily translatable into the civilian workforce. So my sense is that if not presently, there will be a wave of veterans in that age group that will take advantage of a program like this. And you know, also, you know, in my personal perspective, although I did have the benefit of a college education and a law degree, I think that in the economy there is plenty of opportunities for these veterans in vocations that this would be particularly applicable and helpful for, rather than pursuing a four-year or two-year degree. You know, this provides an opportunity for these veterans to be marketable as soon as they come out and can enter into these programs and get the skills and the experiences necessary for their resumes.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Meyer, do you know how many employers, if they knew that this was available, would take and grab latch onto these individuals?
Mr. Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson, obviously it's difficult to predict exactly how many employers would take advantage of the program like this, and quite frankly, in my dealings with employers as an ombudsman, as a representative of ESGR, it strikes me the number of employers who aren't aware not only of the advantages provided by veteran employees, but also the programs that are out there to assist them. Now, at the federal level, there are you know, tax breaks that are coming online that will assist them, and they're becoming more and more aware of this. But I think it is helpful to get the word out, and that's one of the missions of ESGR and working with the county veterans representatives, is not only to serve the employee veterans that are out there and make them more marketable to the civilian employers, but also connect them and with the employers and educate the employers as to what is available. I do not have the study in front of me, but there was a recent study that surveyed employers in terms of their frustrations with having applicants, employee applicants, that are not totally qualified for the positions. Now, of course, when we're in a good economy, it's easy for a business to justify putting the money into training and working with employees to make them, you know, qualified for the position if they lack certain areas before they apply. In this type of an economy, it's hard to ask the employers to incur those costs when they may be facing tight budgets to begin with, and the fact that there is a large pool of applicants that are out there that maybe somebody a little more qualified might take advantage of. So this would certainly provide an incentive for those employers to hire these veterans and provide them that kind of work experience.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Meyer, do you know how many states are doing this?
I have not looked into exactly how many states that are doing it, but I am aware of various programs, not this particular bill, but there are many programs out there, both in collaboration with the ESGR, Department of Defense, but also, you know, initiatives at the state level where they provide these types of incentives.
Thank you.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just reading through the bill, this is for either of you, I'm for moving forward with it. We'd have to say that the 30% unemployment rate with the people that are returning that have sacrificed their time and lives is deplorable in many, many ways. But I'm also noticing that in the bill there's no limiter. So an individual could take advantage of this seemingly 5-6 times potentially. I'm wondering if the author had ever given any thought about, the possibility of saying, you know, no more than 3 times by limiting the amount. Right now, we already have $3,000 aggregate benefits in an annual in one period. Just working with Mr. Shepard here, we could easily put something in that would say no more than $9,000, total, and that would limit it to about 3 times. Any thoughts there?
Representative McElfactor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. Certainly that's something I would be very willing to discuss.
This is going to go to Mr. Chair.
The bill, if we pass it here today, goes to Ways and Means, and if we want to put a limit on, we ought to do it here in committee today.
All right. Mr. Shepherd?
Mr. Shepherd?
Mr. Chair and Representative Benson, Representative McElfetrick, the limit that Representative Benson suggested could be accomplished on page 2, line 5 of the bill, and I will write this down. Before the period, insert, comma, and no more than $9,000 in aggregate benefits under this paragraph may be paid to or on behalf of an individual over any period of time.
Representative McElfetrick, is that language acceptable to you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe that's reasonable, yes.
Okay, so would you want to incorporate that as an oral amendment into your bill?
Mr. Chair, yes, that would be fine.
Okay. Okay, I'm sorry. I guess we have to vote on it. So you make that as a more oral amendment. Discussion on the oral amendment. Everybody clear on the oral amendment?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Banyan.
Just to be sure, this is on an individual, a veteran receiving this, not on an employer.
Mr. Shepherd.
Do I understand that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Banyan, that is correct. The limit would be $9,000 in aggregate benefits under the paragraph that could be paid to or on behalf of an individual.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions on the oral amendment? If not, all in favor of the oral amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried. The oral amendment is adopted. Other questions? Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McElfetrick, I think this is a good bill, and so thank you for bringing it forward. I'm just wondering how we came up with $3,000. Because that seems like a small amount to me, you know, for a retraining program or an apprenticeship program. So I'm just wondering, how did that number come to be?
I'm sorry, Representative McElfetrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that it's probably reflective of the fact that apprenticeship programs and on-the-job training are modest in cost, but perhaps Mr. Meyer would like to address that further.
Mr. Meyer?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Actually, I don't really have any insight into what the cost would be or how that might play out in terms of what the aggregate or total cost of such a program would require.
Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, let's try it and see how it works, you know. The other question that I noticed, this is employer-driven, and I'm wondering, like the building trades, the carpenters unions have apprentice programs, would they be eligible in a subsidy to train a veteran to become a carpenter or an electrician, or does it have to be an employer?
Representative McElfetrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I don't think that I can specifically answer that, but the bill does address the fact that these would have to be approved with input from Department of Labor, Deed, and the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs.
Representative Gauthier.
Just follow up. Representative McElfetrick, I think there's enough leeway in your bill to make it work with an employer and a union working together to make that happen. So I'm glad that you responded the way you did. And I'm going to support your bill.
Any other questions? Anyone else who wishes to be heard? Yeah, Ms. Lee? Ms. Lee, please be very brief. We've got a very tight schedule.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International, Art Our Family Centers, and the Asian Pacific American Housing Consortium. I want to thank Representative McElfetrick. McElfatrick and Senator Perry for bringing this bill forward. This is something that we've talked about for a number of times, and I've also talked to legislators about another issue related to being able to provide more jobs to veterans, military people in the military, and their families. I've sent out a proposed, well, it's not exactly a proposed amendment, although that's what we had start, but I just wanted to talk to you about the concept, where to the extent possible on projects where we can use not just the apprenticeship, but people with these military experience or veterans and their families on bonded projects and things that are coming up before this committee. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lee. our fiscal analyst has raised the question that we ought to address as a committee. Ms. Roberts?
Mr. Chair and members, if you look at the second page of the bill, section 2, this is amending the existing open and statutory appropriation for the Minnesota GI Bill. And on line 2.15, you'll see there's a cap on the amount that can be paid under the subdivision of $6 million, but this cap doesn't begin until July 1st, 2013, which is actually fiscal year 2014. So my suggestion was that we change the 2013 to 2012 to ensure that if the combination of the existing program and any new programs are added to this, that it doesn't go above the $6 million in 2013.
That's an important catch. Representative McElfatrick, would you consider that as an amendment, oral amendment again to your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would. Thank you.
So Representative McElfatrick moves that the date on 2/15 be changed from 2013 to 2012. Discussion? All in favor of that amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. It is amended. Yes, Mr. McElhaney.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mike McElhaney, Legislative Director, Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. And we would first like to thank Representative McElfatrick for bringing this bill forward. As you may well be aware, the governor also has a similar proposal. And we appreciate that she's highlighted the fact that there are a lot of veterans out there that are going to be seeking reemployment. Just recently, I was reading a report from the Bureau of Labor and Statistics that stated that of the 30 fastest growing occupations from 2010 to 2020, 21 of those 30 are going to require an apprenticeship or some sort of on-the-job training. So this opens the door through this mechanism of the current Minnesota GI Bill to expand the training. So we appreciate all her work that she's done. Now, having said that, as we look at this particular language in this bill, we would appreciate if we could work with Representative to highlight and change, I guess, some of the language that we have concerns with. And so on lines 1.8 to 1.2, we have concerns that it's not specific as to who exactly is going to administer this. We understand we'll have to work with DEED and DLI and MDVA. And as we ran some initial analysis, our assumption at this point is that it would take additional FTE to administer this program. And until we are able to further work with DLI and DEED, we have a concern with that. Lines 113 through 114, again, typically we'd need to operate or work further with DEED and DLI because the MDVA doesn't have the capacity and we don't currently certify any sort of programs, apprenticeships or JT. Lines 115 through 117, it only includes post 9/11 veterans and you've heard it before, the post 9/11 veterans are just a portion of the veterans that the department is responsible for and ensuring their needs are met in regards to assisting them in employment and so forth. So we would like to see if we could broaden it a little bit more. I don't know if Representative McElfatrick would be open to that, but that's a request that we would have. Lines 119 through 2.5. Most of the apprenticeships are, and OJT programs are, a year to 24 months long. And so we see there's $2,000 per individual, and that's a fairly good number. However, with the $3,000 cap, which I understand has just been amended, one of the problems that we see is the fact that we would be required to pay most likely $2,000 for the training and then an additional $2,000 for the getting a veteran hired, and then the additional $1,000 at the end of that 12 months, which is more than the eligible cap. And we think that would set potentially the state or the MDVF for some sort of liability claim from an outside employer. So that didn't add up, and we'd like to do a little bit of work on that if possible. Lines 2.12 to 2.16. Typically, one of the problems that we often face in MDVA is the funding that we get in the appropriations. We like to spend the maximum on the veteran, as opposed to, in this bill, we're not exactly sure how this $1,000 credit payable to an eligible employer would be executed, and we don't currently, again, have the capacity to make these annual payments. Again, we would have to potentially look at additional FTE. Appreciate that Representative Benson brought up the point that there was no limit, and that was a little bit confusing, and I apologize that the department doesn't have a fiscal note available. I do recall working with our financial director on this, and some of the things that we looked at, I guess the bottom line that we recall, and again I apologize, was somewhere around $18 million for this program executed the way it is, and that was based on the fact that right now there's 10,713, or at least as of September, veterans receiving federal benefits, and then an additional 707 that are the three-year average between the Minnesota GI Bill usage, which put us up around 11,000 veterans seeking post-secondary or higher education. And then what we do know is from the Defense Manpower data system, there are 40,000 plus veterans that are post 9/11 active duty members or had served on active duty with an address of Minnesota. So that brought us to a usage rate of about, I think it was 9.2%, which was somewhere around the 9,000 number. And then so looking at the usage of, or considering that this expansion gives additionally two more options to the Minnesota GI Bill. There's three post-secondary options available now as opposed to just one. So we would figure that potentially a max number of two-thirds or 66% would be eligible or potentially want to take advantage of this program, which was about 6,000 veterans and or eligible individuals. And so at the max participation rate of 6,000 plus, it was a little over $18 million. And again, as highlighted, there is a $6 million cap, and this amendment will certainly decrease when that would be available, but we would still be capped at $6 million. And so I think overall there's just some areas that we would like to take the opportunity to work with Representative McElfatrick if possible.
Mr. McElnaney, did you convey these along the way here after this bill was introduced?
These
concerns that you're raising?
I did talk with Representative McElfatrick, and I didn't give her any precise information as they just didn't seem to have time to get to that, so I apologize.
Well, members, you know, there have been some issues that he's raising here that we need to get resolved. We have to get this bill to Ways and Means, and I hate to pass on a bill that still has some, we still don't have a real fiscal note, and obviously a couple of the amendments that we put on today will change a fiscal note. And I hate to do that, but I don't think we have any other choice. We need to move this initiative forward, and it's going to be up to Ways and Means then, and between you, Mr. McElnady, and the author of the bill, between now and the time it goes to Ways and Means, to try to get these things resolved so that they can finally act on the bill. I hate to be in that position, but I guess we have no choice. Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I really like the fiscal work on bills to be done in this committee. I think particularly with the time that we've spent hearing it now, and the, you know, I really think it's pretty bad to have concerns brought like that brought up at the last minute. But I think that we could keep the bill here and send it to Ways and Means next week. All it means is it may have to, if it has to go through, remember, deadlines only mean that the bill goes to rules. And I'll stand corrected if I need to be, but my guess is that rules will be meeting every day next week, and I think Ways and Means will be meeting too, and I don't think that we, I don't think that we'd have a problem. And of course I stand ready to be, I saw Mr. Marble shaking his head, so I stand ready to be corrected. But
good luck with that,
Barbara. grumpy looks, but
Representative Kahn, what I said is, you know, I'd prefer to do it here, but we've been told that we cannot let this go until Tuesday. That we're going to have to get the issues resolved before it goes to Ways and Means. But we need to act on this today.
Well,
Representative Kahn.
First of all, you know, Mondays tend to be pretty slow days, and I think we could probably fit in a meeting to put this in place and act on it Monday. But this is a bill, I think, that we've all said very positive things about it. I think we all like it, and I don't think we're going to have problems resolving. I don't think we're going to have problems resolving that issue. And I am right, aren't I, that the rules just say that it just has to, if it misses the deadline, it just has to go to rules. And I remember many easily called rules committee. You know, I just think rules will be meeting a lot. There are a lot of important bills, including at least one of yours, Mr. Chairman, that are going to have to go to rules if they want to get passed. And I don't think it's a problem, but obviously you guys are in charge, so whatever you want to do, do.
Well, Representative Kahn, I'm sorry, but we've been told that this needs to be sent out today, so.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Kahn.
I thought I had taught you that chairmanship of this committee means that you don't do what you're told. You set the rules for the people that you pay. But that's okay. You're different than I am, so.
There's a time to buck the powers that be and a time not to, and this is not a time to do so. Further discussion. We need to get on to the next bills. If not, you want to renew your motion that House File 2909 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to Ways and Means.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Okay. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you, Representative McElpatrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Representative Kiffmeyer. Welcome back, Representative Kiffmeyer. And members, make sure you have the third engrossment that you're looking at and not looking at earlier engrossments. Representative Kiffmeyer, we're up against the wall here, and by 10 to 10, I'm going to have to move to our last bill to take care of that. The alternative, members, is that we'll have to have you back tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that's something that maybe many of you are not looking forward to as a possibility. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Very glad to be with you today. And having initiated my presentation yesterday, I'll be real brief.
And Representative Kiffmeyer, we didn't officially move the bill yesterday, did we?
No.
So I will move House File 2555 for recommend to pass and send to Health and Human Services.
What was that?
That's what we've been told. Representative Kiffmeyer needs to be the routing here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know that Chair Gunther had, on the combat of sports language, done a lot of background and simple thing and has agreed to. And, Mr. Chairman, also yesterday I had an amendment, the A8 amendment, which was agreed to, but I don't know if it was officially.
It wasn't. I will move the A8 amendment. Do you want to speak to it?
Mr. Chairman, this is the language that changes the Combative Sports Commission going to Labor and Industry instead of the Department of Administration, and the rest of the language there is the same. So just that change.
Okay, and we voted?
Yep. Okay.
We voted on it yesterday, so that is on the bill. And there is another amendment that has been requested by Legislative Coordinating Commission.
Mr. Chairman, I agree to that amendment. That's the 810 amendment.
Yep. Oh. I will move the 810 amendment. Do you want to comment? Do you want to
Chairman.
Give us some information about the 810?
Mr. Chairman and members, the Legislative Audit Commission is a very valuable resource for us in the legislature. On the other hand, we need to make sure that we coordinate with them because that value is not used much if we don't enable ourselves to take advantage of their knowledge and expertise. On the other hand, we also need to respect the Legislative Commission's process as far as their direction to the legislative auditor. And this language is agreed to, Mr. Chairman and members, so that we can respect both of those entities and at the same time also use their very valuable knowledge to help conduct the work that is very necessary for the Board of Medical Practice.
Questions on the 810, which would bring the bill to the form that the author would prefer. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm on the Legislative Audit Commission.
Yes.
Is there anyone else here who is? I'm just looking. Oh, right, Representative Kahn. And as members probably know, it's even down the line in terms of all four legislative caucuses, and we have a good tradition of working bipartisanly. And I guess my only concern, and maybe either Representative Kiffmeyer or the legislative auditor himself, Mr. Nobles, who's here, can comment. I just want to make sure, as a matter of just the integrity of the group, that we're not breaching a barrier here in terms of, I can't recall ever seeing anything in statute recommending that the Legislative Audit Commission request something. So I just want to make careful, be careful that we preserve the integrity of that process, and there's no one who would have the institutional memory, I think, that's better than the legislative auditor who's been doing this since the early 80s. So it's okay with
sure.
you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Nobles.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and thank you, Representative Simon. And I think you all do understand that over the years, the Legislative Audit Commission has established a process of using its authority to direct the legislative auditor to do certain evaluations. This year, for example, we received over 90 requests for evaluations, and then the Legislative Audit Commission's Topic Selection Subcommittee recently narrowed that list to 14 finalists, and you members are in the process of giving us further direction in the Legislative Audit Commission towards which of those 14 you would prefer. The Legislative Audit Commission's Topic Selection Subcommittee will be meeting on Monday morning, and then the full commission will meet to make a final decision. That process is ongoing under the law. It's what we refer to as the Paragraph A process, but there is a Paragraph B process, which is referenced in this amendment. It is not frequently used, but it is a legally authorized method by which a member can put a suggestion before the Legislative Audit Commission. And so I think it is within keeping to the integrity of the process. Again, it is outlined in law. It does not by any means guarantee that the Legislative Audit Commission will ultimately choose to authorize the legislative auditor to do this evaluation, but it is a mechanism to put it before the Legislative Audit Commission. The only other thing I would say is that clearly the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice is under the jurisdiction of the legislative auditor. We would have authority to conduct this evaluation in a way that I think no other organization would, and that is we do have access to all data regardless of classification, and there are some concerns about how the Board of Medical Practice has responded to certain allegations of malpractice of people they regulate. And so I think if that evaluation is going to be done in the way that I think people would like it to be done, we would be the organization that would have the authority to do it.
Representative Simon.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Nobles. But what is the status right now, as you understand it, within the Legislative Audit Commission or the evaluation process of making sure this topic is on the list?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, the status is that there is some uncertainty because there are members of the Legislative Audit Commission that are very protective of the paragraph A process. So it's yet to be worked out. I would just say very quickly, Mr. Chairman, and I've appeared before you before on this question. As the legislative auditor, I really want to be as helpful as I possibly can towards the work of the Sunset Commission. And I have met frequently with Representative Kiffmeyer to try to work that out. But I think we need to move that to the level of a more formal discussion between the Legislative Audit Commission and representatives of the Sunset Commission, because there is a certain protectiveness of the resources, which are quite limited at the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And yet, to the degree I can, I would like to find a path forward to help the Sunset Commission, because resources are limited. I think we need to fully utilize the resources we already have to make the legislative branch a strong and effective oversight function. So that will be my approach, but I am not fully at have an ability to make that happen. I do have to work that through the Legislative Audit Commission, and I intend to try to do that.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm mindful of the time, too, so I'm trying to cut to the chase here. So, as I understand it, this sort of tells the narrative. I'm trying to follow the bouncing ball here, which is that the Sunset Commission has made a request for an evaluation of the Act, the Minnesota Medical Practice Act, and its implementation by the board. And so the request here is that, consistent with the Sunset Commission's request, that we ask the Legislative Audit Commission, we don't tell them, but we ask them to request that your office do this scoping document.
Yes.
Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, and that request has been made, both in this language and a letter that Representative Kiffmeyer and Senator Bonoff sent to the chair and vice chair of the Legislative Audit Commission. Right. So the language you have in front of you is in process. I think putting it in the law is just another mechanism and provides an alternative. If the Legislative Audit Commission does not authorize this evaluation this year, then there is another option that the Sunset Commission can pursue.
Right. Okay.
We had a couple people.
And Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to mention, too, that for Representative Simon, that I have met with Representative Beard and Senator Rest and the members of the commission almost a month ago now, and just initiating that conversation.
We're on the A-10 amendment. Representative Gunther, is your point to the A-10 amendment? Representative Kahn, to the A-10?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, further questions on the A-10 amendment? Representative Simon.
One more. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Kiffmeyer, are you intending that if we pass the A-10 amendment, which pertains to Section 28, that we don't really need to touch or significantly alter Section 27, which we discussed briefly yesterday? I mean, is this meant to sort of satisfy those concerns or not necessarily?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Simon. This amendment on the A-10 can work with the working group, but Representative Simon, I would anticipate by the time we get to HHS Finance that some of those other specifications of membership, some of those other things, and who does it, that we would have the work group, but maybe convened a little differently, as you have expressed your concerns already, but I think they can work together.
Representative Simon.
And Mr. Chair, yeah, one of the concerns I expressed yesterday, or at least it wasn't a concern so much, it's just something I think needs to be done, is to plug in the numbers of members, because under Section 27, it just says, for example, on 11.26, it says members of the Board of Medical Practice. 11.27 says practicing physicians, doesn't say how many. I'm not saying we need to do that here and today, and we probably don't have time, but right. I trust that somewhere along the process that will be done. I guess the point I was making was, my suggestion yesterday, before we ran out of time, was that maybe Mr. Nobles and the Office of Legislative Auditor could handle the convening in line 11.20 of this study. I guess what I'm wondering is that would that be redundant if we offer this amendment, if we accept this amendment?
Mr. Nobles?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, members. Well, when we do an evaluation, we do it on our own authority and terms, and although we often seek and always seek a lot of input from affected parties, we typically don't formally convene a working group, but if we're directed to do that, we could. Or you could have that working group convened and do its work independent of our evaluation, because it would provide two different perspectives. So I think, as Representative Kiffmeyer was saying, as we sit here today, we're not quite sure what path forward we're going to take, but I think over the next several days that will become a little more clear.
One more, thank you. I just want to make sure, Mr. Nobles, I know you're in a precarious position of trying to be helpful to us, but I guess I'll ask you, if you care to comment, maybe you won't, would it be burdensome, or would it be, would it get in the way if, after adopting the A10 amendment, we would also make you the convener of what's going on in Section 27? I mean, I don't want to do it if you don't want to do it. That's why I'm asking.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I'm directed to do it, I will do it. I think that question really is one more for Representative Kiffmeyer. You know, we will do our work according to our authority, which would not necessarily require convening a working group. We can seek that input by our own methods. But Representative Kiffmeyer may have more interest and need to have that language kept in the bill, so I would defer to her.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Simon. Representative Simon, this amendment going on that we have here now, the 810, would affect then some of the structuring of the work group. And I share those concerns that Mr. Nobles has shared as well. I don't want to overburden that. But Representative Simon, I think it has the practitioners are in the work group. The work that Mr. Nobles does is a perspective, but I don't want to lose sight of the practitioners being able to give input into this process. It's very, very important. So exactly how it would be structured, who would convene it, could be, I haven't had the conversations with all the parties yet to add that, but Representative Simon, I'll be glad to work with you on that, and I would appreciate any of your suggestions, but I think this A10 amendment helps us do that, and then it gives more, then we can go forward with greater specificity on the work group.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence. Yeah, what I like about what you've done in this A10 amendment is we know that one way or another this is going to be looked into, which is great. It's got either going to be Mr. Nobles, or if not, by default, then it will go to the Department of Administration. So we know that at least it's going to be looked at, and I think that's the most important thing.
To the A10 amendment, Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, and we had a somewhat extensive discussion about this in the Government Operations Committee. My concern about the A10 amendment is reflects a broader concern about this bill, which is that I think the Sunset Advisory Commission is going beyond the scope of its responsibilities and involving itself in substantive areas of policy and budget that are not its province. If you look at the language in the enabling legislation, it talks about sunsetting, it talks about extending, and it talks about making suggestions on the reform of operations of a committee or board. And I think the A10 is not the worst example in the bill if we adopt it, but I'm going to be voting no on the A10. I don't think it's the role of the Sunset Advisory Commission to determine which boards, which agencies and should be determining whether they are the best place for these kind of substantive decision making. I just think that's beyond their scope. I think the A10 is not the worst example, but I think it's just a it furthers this the trend in the bill, which I'm going to talk to in a few minutes, of I think really exceeding the authority of the commission and the exceeding the authority that's provided to it in the Enabling Act. And I think if we don't have some precedent and some limitation that we set about how far they can go, it essentially becomes a committee that can review anything at all anywhere in state law and state government and the state budget and start passing on bills and making the fate of agencies held hostage to whatever the whims of the Sunset Advisory Commission might be. And if we don't dial that back to some degree, I think one way or the other, whether it's, you know, this legislature, future legislatures, this majority, different majorities, this governor, different governors, I think the precedent of having wide-ranging authority to shoehorn policy and budget and other kinds of issues in a bill that would otherwise sunset boards and commissions and agencies is a bad place for us to go. I wish the governor had not accepted this to begin with, but given that he did, I think we should exercise some discipline and not use this as a vehicle for omnibus reform.
To the 810, Representative Banyan.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if you want to stop me, I wanted to respond to some of the broader comments that Representative Winkler made. But if you'd rather just move the A-10 along and then we can come back to that, I will.
Okay. To the A-10 amendment. All in favor of the A-10 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. Motion carries. The A-10 amendment is adopted. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. In light of your time, I know that you are a finance committee, so I come to you today with some good information. On the fiscal note, in particular, under the legislative, I think if I just take them one at a time, Mr. Chairman, I'm not quite sure. I have a preliminary fiscal note here. Is there another document that is easier for you, Ms. Roberts, that you may have?
Ms. Roberts?
Mr. Chair, members, I don't have another document that I've made copies of, but I can point members to the appropriate page if you're talking about the legislative costs specifically.
No, Mr. Chairman. Maybe it'll be easier if I just simply just state to you that I have had discussions with the Department of Administration. There will be no fiscal note from the Department of Administration, wherever its line is on the piece of paper. I think the important thing is, Mr. Chairman, that in discussions with the Department of Administration, and they are here today, and they are able to, they have agreed to that and have informed me of that, so that would be a zero. In regards to the legislative Coordinating Commission, the LCC, Mr. Chairman, that will also be zero for this fiscal year, and the expenses for the Sunset Commission or the funding for them would be going into the next fiscal year. And in regards to the Enterprise Technology Office, the legislation, there was an amendment in the previous committee that they haven't caught up with yet, that instead of a 25% reduction in fees, it's 5%, and it's delayed by 2 years. So there is no fiscal note impact for the office of, for the OET. And, Mr. Chairman, I believe that addresses the... Oh, and Mr. Nobles is here as well, and the OLA also does not need a general fund appropriation. So, Mr. Chairman, I believe with that, for our current fiscal year, that brings it to a zero.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
On the general fund.
We have some blanks in Section 29. Do you have numbers at this time for that?
They would actually, Mr. Chairman, those would be deleted because there would be no appropriation for, Mr. Chairman, so we can delete those sections.
So you're suggesting Section 29 would be deleted?
Mr. Chairman, Section 29. Yes, Mr. Chairman. Except for, Mr. Chairman, line 13.5 to the OLA to 13.8 would be deleted. For lines 13.2 to 13.4. I think the amount is $207,000. And instead of June 30th, 2013, it would be June 30th, 2014. With these fiscal years, Ms. Roberts, if that gets it into that next fiscal year.
Ms. Roberts?
Mr. Chair and members, I would point out that in practice we don't usually appropriate for the next biennium. So you
and it would be just zero.
You could, if you don't want to appropriate any money for fiscal year 2013, you could just remove Section 29. And then the next legislature could deal with this issue in the next budget session.
So do you want us to take Section 29 out, given Ms. Roberts?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, I will move that we delete Section 29. Discussion to that amendment. Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, I apologize if I'm slow on the uptake. Is the intention that the staff would not ever be hired then because this is deleted, and so there would never be a fiscal cost, or is the intention to hire staff and put the fiscal costs in a future budget?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In discussion, the major part of the work of the Sunset Advisory Commission comes in that next year because of reviewing of the Department of Health, Department of Human Services, very large entities. And so, again, I had anticipated that there would be this need for staff, but not until that next fiscal year. But I'm just leaning to your advice that says if I'm not able to do that funding in place for that next fiscal year, at this time, I don't know how to proceed, but my intention would have been to just that it wouldn't be necessary for this fiscal year, but for the next fiscal year, it would be.
Representative Kiffmeyer, I assume that that work would not begin until after the 2013 legislative session has ended, correct?
That's correct.
And so there should not be any need for any funding then. I mean, this is an issue that would have to be resolved by the next legislative session.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that is what I thought that I heard from both you and Ms. Roberts. So, but I just want to be clear, it is not that there wouldn't be a request to have that funding, or right, that there would be a need for that, but not funding it in this fiscal year is the matter that's before you today.
It's just a delayed request is what it would amount to. Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, just to be clear, I think in the Legislative Coordinating Commission has, I would assume, authority to hire what staff it would want to for whatever purpose it would want to. And so you may have to have legislation in 2013 in order to have them hire staff. They may do it on their own. We don't know. But at this point, absent Section 29, the only way we are hiring staff for the Sunset Advisory Committee is if the LCC acts on its own. That's my understanding. I guess I'd look for confirmation for that.
Representative Kiffmeyer, you want to respond to that?
Mr. Chairman, we have currently been functioning by using the resources of the LCC in a modest way, and we appreciate their time. And they have agreed for the rest of this fiscal year to go ahead and continue working with us.
And the resources of this committee.
And the resources of and Mr. Chairman, absolutely. The resources of this committee is very much appreciated. I'm just respectful of their time.
To the oral amendment. To the oral amendment. The oral amendment is to remove Section 29. All in favor of that amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. The amendment is adopted. We have a number of folks who wanted to raise questions. Representative Kiffmeyer, is there anything before we go to that?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Next, Representative Gunther.
I just want to say that I do not require to hear this bill because of the Combative Sports Commission going to Dolly, which is under the purview of my committee. The commissioner is very anxious to have it happen.
Okay. Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just needed to respond briefly to
Representative Winkler, every 12 years, every agency in this state government comes before the Sunset Advisory Commission. A lot of information is provided by those agencies to the commission. The commission then makes a set of recommendations. That commission includes eight legislators. Legislators take ideas from that particular activity, and they will bring legislation to this body. I don't understand really why it would be that a member couldn't bring legislation beyond the dating of sunset. It's not the Sunset Advisory Commission that's bringing you this legislation. It's Representative Kiffmeyer holding an election certificate just like the other 133 of us. She has the right to bring that legislation here, informed by what she learned when she was at the commission. If you don't like parts of the bill, move to get rid of them. But it's our job to go ahead and talk about the issues that we learn in our process as a legislator, not just here within the body, but when we're sitting in the commission. And I think it's perfectly reasonable for the chair of the commission, who probably has as much information as any of us, to bring a bill that helps reform government in all the ways that she's learned in her process as being the chair. And so I fully support this bill.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Banny and I have moved to delete sections of the bill in the prior committee, and it wasn't successful. But your statement is just not correct. And it's a pretty simple reason why. Because if there isn't legislation, these boards and commissions are going to expire. And absent legislation, that will happen. So if this bill needs to move through the legislature in order for these boards and commissions to continue, and that's the pressure point that the legislative majority holds and can push anything that it chooses along with those boards and commissions. The governor is really only empowered to veto the bill, which would result in the sunset of the commissions and boards. Now, I know that in the present political situation, you think that's terrific. I mean, these are groups that deal with minority organizations and minority communities in our state, and generally speaking, that may not be a top priority, and you may think Governor Dayton is going to be more sympathetic to those things. But the shoe can be on the other foot, and other boards and commissions can sunset, and all will, absent legislation. And a Republican governor and a Democratic legislature has the tables flipped. And there may be boards and commissions that a Republican governor really wants to hold on to. And a Democratic majority in the legislature will say, sorry, we're going to sunset them, we're going to let them die, unless you accept our omnibus government reform package, which contains whatever whims the Sunset Advisory Commission members might bring forward. So I think it's a dangerous place to go, that this advisory commission can delve into whatever kinds of activities, interests, policy ideas, anything that it wants. There is nothing that isn't germane to this, as far as I can tell. And I'm just suggesting that it's a dangerous place to go. And it may, my suggestion to the governor would be to veto the bill and say that he demonstrate that he's willing to sunset anything that he wants to, but he's not going to accept the legislature pushing through an unrelated agenda. So I think that's the danger. That's the concern. And in particular, Section 28 of the bill, of the engrossment, mandates fee reductions. Section 21 requires boards to do background checks. Now, Representative McElpatrick has a bill on background checks, right, and has worked with stakeholders to actually come up with a bill on background checks for the nursing board that I think is a good bill. I'm a co-author on it. This bill in Section 21 has its own section related to background checks. And it's good that it's going to the Health and Human Services Committee, but this is not the appropriate vehicle for a bill related to health licensing and health licensing fees on the substantive issue of background checks and fees that they're paid. I just think that's way beyond the scope of the Sunset Advisory Commission. Granted, the members can do anything they want, introduce any bill that they want, but absent a piece of legislation that continues those boards and commissions, they all expire. So it's really just a way of holding them hostage to push through an agenda, and it's not appropriate. And I'm suggesting to you that on both sides of the aisle, we will regret the creation of this monster if we allow it to go forward without some restraint.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I really want to, this kind of follows up some of the objections that I made to the first bill, that the appropriate actions that we're asking the Sunset Commission to do are really actions that should be taken by either the policy committees or, more appropriately, the finance committees in terms of doing that. And to set an overriding broader commission that doesn't, you know, and I kind of don't object when they're just, well, I did object because it's an unnecessary level of governance when they're going after these kind of things that don't have a lot of stuff to do anyway. But if we want to do in-depth study of something that's as important as the Board of Medical Practice review, the people who I want to do it are not the legislators serving on the Sunset Commission, but I really want the legislators and staff on the Health and Human Services Finance Committee to do it. And ideally, I haven't exactly looked at how we're set up in that area. I know we've kind of failed in how we set it up in the government operations area. Ideally, there ought to be a relationship between the people on the policy committee and the people on the finance committee, and which I don't think we've kept well enough to do. But I think if you want, you know, it's a very bad idea to put this other layer in, which will never, and it was the objection that I had last year and the first time, is that we weren't putting any funding or giving any staff to the Sunset Commission, and we're essentially giving a job to people to do at a place where it's going to be almost impossible for them to do it, as opposed to the in-depth, every biennial legislative session for at least the appropriations committees. You know, they're just the harder-nosed committees in this body. The policy committees tend to be advocates for the entities under their coverage, and we tend to be the people who put the brakes on them, whether it's been in a Democratic or a Republican legislature. And I think this expanding the authority, again without staff and without appropriation, and this idea of if you're writing the bill and you're telling them what to do and you're not giving them the appropriation until the next year, then obviously the time to write the bill is the next year. So I'm certainly going to join Representative Winkler in voting against this bill. And I am, you know, as I said last year, I don't think we ought to have the Sunset Commission ought to be the legislative committees on the order of this committee. And they ought to do their job, and if they're not doing their job, putting a set of people in who don't possibly have the time and the expertise, maybe with the exception of Representative Kiffmeyer, who I think can get expertise in anything really fast, but to do a good job is a real mistake.
Members, we're out of time. Representative Banyan?
Very short question, Mr. Chair. Representative Kiffmeyer, how many committees is this bill traveling through?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
And Representative Banyan, I believe this is the fourth committee, and there'll be a couple more as well. And Mr. Chairman, just to let you know, the recommendations in statute are for this Sunset Advisory Commission. Make recommendations on the abolition, continuation, or reorganization of each affected and its advisory committees, on the need for the performance of the functions and its advisory committees. And there are several sections in statute. So I think we've been true to what the legislature has asked of the Sunset Advisory Commission. And those recommendations here are reflected in this bill. Mr. Chairman, I ask for your vote and support for House File 2555.
Well, since there are people that still want to talk about this, and we've got another bill that we have to address, we have no choice, but we're going to have to call you all back tomorrow at 8:15. We'll have to let you know what room we're able to get at that hour. It's unfortunate that we're in that position, but
Mr. Chair, my question's real quick.
Representative Lilly.
If that's helpful at all. Mr. Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, I just have a question on the combative sports part, and then Representative Gunther brought it up. It just seems like it should be not with the administration. It just seems to me it maybe should be more in the public safety sector. then has that been dealt with, or oh, so I'm wrong. Okay,
Mr. Chairman, just a quick response.
Again,
they've
short.
All been consulted, and it is the Department of Labor and Industry that everybody has agreed, Department of Health, Admin, Department of Public Safety, they've all been consulted and agreed to that it would be with best with Dolly, Department of Labor and Industry.
Thank you.
Members, we're going to lay over House File 2555 till tomorrow, and we'll take up the 2269 tomorrow as well. 8:15, we'll let you know the room. Meeting adjourned.